Hi, this is John Ryan with Team Handball News, and joining me on the line is Krister Aull. We're going to talk a little bit about the officiating and the new rules here going on with the Olympic tournament. Some of you listened to our earlier podcast where we speculated a little bit about what might happen. We're now halfway through group play almost. So now we're going to talk and talk a little bit about how things have played out. And the first rule that we're going to cover is the goalkeeper as a player being more simple to do now that anybody can come in and come out. I'll just start out by saying it's even, you know, teams were already starting to do this. They were already starting to pull a keeper and bring in a court player with the bib. Now they're really starting to do it, aren't they, Krister?
Yes, I mean, it's kind of ironic that after so many countries complained about this rule before the Olympics, that now we are seeing much more of it than I had ever expected.
It's almost standard practice if you're down a man.
Yeah, I mean, that you're right. That is the situation. It's not so much that they had talked about that they would try to play 7 against 6, but more playing 6 against 6 when they have a player sent out.
It did happen a couple times. I saw Germany play 7 on 6 a little bit. So there's teams that are doing it, but you're right. It's really mostly focused on our team's down a man. Let's play a normal game, a normal offense, if you will. And it's backfired on a few teams, though, hasn't it?
Well, you know, that's why it's so surprising. I mean, they complained that they haven't had a chance to practice and get used to it. And now that's what shows up. They still use it. But then it backfires because I don't think they have gotten their system down pat. So that far too often they get goals scored against in an empty net instead.
Yeah, it would be really interesting to tabulate, at the conclusion of the Olympic tournaments, just what the expected value was in terms of points scored for each time a team did that in a possession.
Yeah, I mean, it might be fun to, one indication would be if you look at how many goals so far have been scored by goalkeepers, which typically has been in this situation.
Well, yeah, they're having a field day, relatively speaking. It used to be a fairly rare occurrence.
Yeah,
and
indeed.
Now it's like, you know, the goalie's not out. We're gonna toss it down the end of the court. But like you have said before, it's no guarantee that just because that goal is empty that you're gonna get a goal. There's been more than one occasion where teams have failed to take advantage of that circumstance.
Yeah, 35, 40 meters is quite some distance to get the right precision after all. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But
you know, John, there is one thing that has occurred to me when we say that they use it so much when they are a player down. I would be intrigued to see if it would occur to them to use it when they're a player up, when the opponent's defense is a player short, to really make sure to take advantage by taking the risk of getting the goalie out and playing 7 against 5. Because typically it won't occur to the short-handed opponents to try so much to score in those situations. That could really guarantee that they get an extra goal or two.
Well, and I think it would be really interesting, kind of like in American football, the high school team that never punts.
Yep.
They literally go for it on fourth down, no matter where they are on the field. It'd be really interesting to see the team that never plays with less than seven players on offense. Yep. If somebody really wanted to push it and see what would happen going 7 on 6, that would be really interesting to see how that would play out over 60 minutes.
I think that would probably take some years with this rule, because the veteran top-level handball coaches, they are so much into their set ways or traditions that for them to gamble like that, I have my doubts they would.
All right. Well, let's move on to the second rule that we talked about. This is the new rules on player injuries where if the medical team comes on the court, the player has to go out for three offensive possessions. I thought I saw one situation where it worked as a deterrent. I highlighted that in the article where Irina Bliznova, she is a wiry player that likes to attack, but she's also somewhat slight and hits the ground a lot. It looked to me like one time they were about ready to call in the medical team and that she hopped up to her feet against South Korea, particularly when in the situation they were in where they were trying successfully, I might add, to get a big comeback against the Koreans.
Yeah,
I don't know for sure if that happened. Maybe it's happened some other times. Why don't you give me your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I've seen a couple of situations like that. But, you know, I'm more interested in not so much getting genuinely injured players up quicker. I have been more pleased to see, although I cannot swear, of course, that this is to the credit of this particular rule, that some of those teams that for years and years have had this habit of, you know, big, strong guys spinning around on the floor, screaming and shouting when they have got a finger injury or a small push that didn't seem to almost justify them going down on the floor. And that was really what frustrated people and caused this rule to come into existence. And this time we haven't seen virtually anything of that.
You know, I think you're right. Again, that's something you'd have to kind of track. I will say, looking at the, I'll just do a brief segue on how awesome NBC's coverage is of the handball tournament with this online streaming through my Roku. You know, every game's available, and they always put the time, how long the game took to play. They're not. You know, we're not running into any two-hour monstrosities. Most of the games are getting played in about an hour and 35 minutes or so, which is what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think that is having an impact on how fast the game is being played. There's fewer stoppages.
Yeah. There's only one aspect of this rule that I have not quite liked, but seemed to happen two, three times in the many games that I watch, and that is that referees, when they sense that there is this player who was fouled, although not too badly, and is on the floor and might need help, that then as an afterthought, not in the normal, quick, immediate way, but as an afterthought, when they see that the player is getting up and would be subject to this rule, then suddenly they give 2 minutes to the player.
I was just gonna mention that it seemed like some of the officials almost feel like, well, that guy got hit pretty good. If I don't give the 2 minute, he's gonna have to go out for three times.
Yep,
that's your sense too.
Absolutely, and that I really hate to see.
Okay, well, I guess it'll be interesting to play out if they actually have a star player who's thinking he's going to get that 2 minute, doesn't get that 2 minute. Well, maybe that'll come back as a better deterrent.
Yeah, let's think.
I will say, though, I think you're right, though. I think it is, there's less of that going on, though.
Yep.
I think in most cases, those guys are actually fouled pretty hard.
Yeah, I mean, we have several teams in this tournament who have had this tradition for decades to annoy us with their theatrics, and suddenly it seems I'm almost to have gone away. So I'm happy about that.
All right, let's move on to the passive play rule changes in the six passes.
Yep.
I have not seen them get to the sixth pass yet. Maybe I haven't watched every minute though. Have you seen that happen yet?
No, I haven't. I mean, I cannot swear either, because sometimes they have whistled, but I mean, it's because of some, travel or offensive foul when the attacking players get desperate. But what instead I have seen, which is both good and bad, it's good in the sense that the rule works then as a deterrent, but bad because it looks so awful, that players get into a sudden panic when they see the hand signal and take it up to the crazy shot after three or four passes.
It seems like that's happened, although, you know, that kind of used to happen a little bit in the past as well.
Yeah, although not quite as quickly or as desperately, because they knew that the referees had leeway, and if the defending players were trying to tie them up and so on, then the referees were giving them a bit more time. So, but now they know that the referees have no choice, so now they have to shoot.
Yeah, and you know, we were joking a little bit about whether it was five passes or six.
Yep.
I'm telling you, as an observer, I've been trying to say, okay, the hand's up now, or did I not quite see it when that hand went up? So is that the first or the second of the sixth pass?
Yeah, that's the problem.
I got to thinking this probably the same way if the players, too.
Yeah, they have to be alert.
And suddenly they see the hands up, and they didn't see whether how long it's been up.
Yeah, right.
So, but again, I think it's actually working a little bit as a deterrent.
Yes.
We're not getting there.
That's what we were hoping.
Yeah. All right. Now we'll talk about the last 30 seconds of the game rules.
Yeah.
I was watching Argentina play last night against Croatia. And with 9 seconds left, Argentina had the ball, but a silly turnover. Croatian player has it in the backcourt on defense. He's getting ready to pass the ball to a teammate, and he's fouled. And, oh, the play stopped. And I'm immediately thinking to myself, am I seeing the first instance of the last 30-second rule? Are they going to call a penalty? And I was like, well, it looks like, oh, that looks like a hand penalty for a signal. And sure enough, Croatia was given a penalty shot with 9 seconds left. Nobody was in the act of shooting. And I said to myself, therefore, this is the first major instance of that rule being used. But, Krister, you corrected me. How was I wrong?
Well, you know, I first thought, just like you, that this might be it. And then I was saying, in that case, it's a terrible mistake by the referees, because they penalized this foul, this desperate foul from the Argentinian player, clearly with 2 minutes. And if that's the case, then it could never lead to a penalty if thrown 7 meters down at the other end. That could only happen if they judged that it was a red card situation, disqualification. So I wondered, but then it occurred to me, gosh, it's something totally different, because the Argentinians, and with nothing to lose in that moment, had taken out their goalie. So the goal was empty, and that it means that, contrary to what you might have surmised, that he was ready to pass the ball, that he had a chance to throw the ball, otherwise unimpeded, down the length of the court, as we discussed before, into the empty net. And that meant that under a rule that has existed for 20 years, by definition, that is destroying a clear goal-scoring chance. And that in itself, whenever it happens during the game, having nothing to do with this last 30 seconds rule, is a 7-meter.
Does it have to be an actual shot from that player, or would it also be an opportunity to score if he had been able to throw it to somebody a little bit away from him who would have had a empty net?
No, if he passes off the ball, then it cannot be. I mean, you have to recognize an attempt to take advantage directly, throwing at the empty goal, but that can be a tough matter of judgment. I'm sure some Argentinians will say that, I have my doubts that he really did see this opportunity and did try to do that. But with this, it's almost like, you know, forward motion. It's like in American football, the judgment of what was the quarterback doing, sort of.
All right. So it wasn't necessarily it was a judgment call on the official's part that he had a scoring opportunity, the player that was fouled.
Well, the scoring opportunity by definition existed. But whether he was trying to take advantage of it or not, that was the judgment.
Okay. All right. Well,
very fine point there, yes.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it'll come up at some point. No one has yet gotten the blue card. Am I correct in that?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Well, you know, that's a trivia question someday. Who was the first person to get a blue card in international play? But not yet. I guess if the Argentine player had really clobbered the guy there, that might have been a place if he had tackled him. But that wasn't the case. It was a hard foul, but it wasn't quite that hard foul, that hard of a foul. Something that just came up to me, seems like there's been a few more red cards than normal. But that's also something that has been trending even before the Olympic tournament.
Yes, and I've seen, to some extent, some very good red card decisions, direct red cards. And, of course, in fact, quite a few because of accumulation of 3 2-minute penalties. But the ones I have seen pulling back the shooting arm in a very dangerous way, or giving someone a good shove in the back when they jump in and over the goal area, have been absolutely justified. And just today, in the most recent game played here today, there was one for hitting the goal in the face on a 7-meter. That one was a little bit marginal to my taste, but I could justify it.
Oh, okay. And also, it seems like a foul to the face. That's also, is that, that that's
yeah, I mean, that is a point of emphasis, generally speaking, that fouls to the face, that it really has to be quite serious, blatant, dangerous to give a direct red card. But it should really, anything against the head or the neck should for sure give a 2-minute penalty right away. And that has happened a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, somebody's a little bit old school to me. It feels like they're playing pansy handball a little bit, but you know, they've changed the rules. They've emphasized it and it's getting called.
Yeah.
You know, I just say that from, you know, I think some of these plays that people have gotten direct red cards, if you were to transport somebody from 20 years in the past, they're going to go, you got to be kidding me. How's that a red card?
Yeah.
But like you said, that's something that they've emphasized and folks need to know the rules.
Exactly. No, that has been the trend over the years to encourage the referees to be stricter on that because players have become too cynical and too reckless.
Okay. All right. I think that covers the rules pretty good. What's your thoughts about the officiating in general so far at the tournament? And for those of you who aren't aware, this used to be Krister's job. He was the guy at the major tournament, you know, evaluating officials, how well they're doing, and assigning officials to matches. So this is very near to Krister's heart. This is something that he really knows well and has been intimately involved. So what's your take so far on the officiating?
Well, you know, I got my first scare when I saw the list of referees nominated for Rio. And of course, I was not that surprised at the time, although perhaps the geopolitics where referees from other continents had been taken a bit far. But right now, and I have to say that I feel sorry for my successors, we have a tough situation. We don't have that many really strong couples to fill out all the slots in an Olympic tournament, unfortunately. I was sometimes a bit nervous back in Beijing 2008 or before that I had to sort of a little bit take some risks in some games. But now that's almost par for the course. There are only 5-6 really strong pairs that can be used for any game in this tournament. And that means that we have seen some performances that are not sort of negative surprises, but simply are as sort of shaky as I had feared they would be.
Yeah, I mean it's a big difference between being a Bundesliga ref and refing maybe two matches a week at a very high level, And, you know, somebody that's maybe in a, you know, non-traditional handball country that doesn't have the level of professional play, that's a tall order, you know, to immediately then step on the floor with the best players in the world. I think I've seen some calls that are questionable, but I don't think I've seen too many that were well, you would know more than me. Maybe to the me as a naive observer, I haven't, you know, been totally outraged at any point, I guess.
Well, it's more the inconsistency, you know, that between the stronger couples and the ones that, who are not that good at detecting and judging or having the sort of the instincts or courage to get it right. And also that some of the couples are not able to maintain consistency during the course of the games. It almost looks like it's a bit lottery. And that means that a team could, you know, be disadvantaged just by bad luck. But, you know, John, one thing that I think we should point out, you know, we are used to world championships these days, men or women, with 24 teams. And of course, you know, you have from top to bottom quite a big spread between the very best and the weaker ones. And that means that there are a lot of games that are not that difficult or not that close. But in the Olympics, with 12 men's teams and 12 women's teams in playing in parallel, that means that basically every game is a close one. There are no really weak teams, and that it's really tough. There is a lot of intensity, not just because it's the Olympics, but because all the teams are really that strong and that all the games become that difficult.
Yeah, there are, and that's a good segue into our next section. There are no gimme games.
No.
I have been really surprised on that. And are you telling me that, like, when I went to the World Championships, I didn't get the best pair that was available, you know, for Team USA, you know, that they would give an inexperienced pair because they knew we didn't have a chance of winning? Is that what you're
telling
me?
Well, I think there may have been some of that, yes. I would imagine now that the only team you could pick on of the 24 teams this time, it would be the Argentina women's team who probably end up getting the less experienced referees every game.
Sure. Yeah, but even that has been, they've surprised me as well a little bit at times. All right. You know, we're going to wrap up this section of the podcast, and I'm going to record the next section on another MP3, and hopefully we'll get that up pretty soon. But hope you've enjoyed this referee conversation and conversation on the rules at the Olympic Games. For Chris Terrell, I'm John Ryan, and signing off, and we'll see you next time.